You're listening to SageCast, the podcast of Pomona College, where this season we're talking with faculty and alumni who are taking on challenges and tackling the difficult. I'm Travis Cacciatorian.
And I'm Marilyn Thompson. Recently, Chinasa Okolo, class of 2018, came to campus to talk with students studying computer science. She's working in the Brookings Institution, researching the rapidly growing field of artificial intelligence.
Chinasa is taking special interest in Africa and how leveraging AI can advance global health. Here's that conversation. Chinasa, welcome to SageCast.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be back.
It looks like your main area of research is artificial intelligence. I'm very curious as to what led you down that path.
Yeah, so I would say my interest, you know, just grew as a computer science major here at Pomona. I really got to learn more about AI and also the implications of AI through a senior project that I did for my major. Through that year, I had the opportunity to work with Professor Alexandra Papuzaki. She was the first professor in the department to really focus on human-computer interaction. And I had the opportunity to work with the system that she developed throughout her PhD. And so basically the system was focused on eye tracking, but to track eyes, it first had to like track the face. And so when I tested it out on myself, I found out that it actually wasn't really tracking my face super well unless I happened to be in direct lighting. And so during that time also, there was a lot of research that came out surrounding, you know, the implications of face tracking, and also primer work from Joy Blum-Winnie that showed like bias in facial recognition systems. And so that work also like had an impact on my journey in AI, and then also just like how I, you know, chose to pursue the rest of my senior research as well. So,
what is AI? How would you explain AI to people who read it all the time and then either jump immediately to ChatGPT or go, I know it's coming, I know it's here, I know it's important, I'm not quite sure what it is?
Yeah, so I would classify artificial intelligence as being a field of computer science that aims to make machines, you know, like computers, phones, watches, for example, think and behave like humans. And the goal is really just to solve a variety of problems that include like learning, identification, planning, reasoning, and decision making.
A lot of what we read and hear in the US media right now about AI is either about how it's going to put us all out of work, or it's going to do all the students' homework for them, or it's going to be doing ever more dangerous disinformation. Yet you're doing things that seem a lot more positive. Tell us about your work.
So my work as a PhD student really focused on, you know, community healthcare workers. I refer to them also as like CHWs. As I talk, how these workers in rural India understand and perceive AI. And so this is really just important just because in India, you know, there's a lot of technological innovation that's going on. You know, a lot of it's from the government and also from different nonprofits and big tech companies that are based, you know, within the country. And so these applications are really targeting the work of community healthcare workers. But there wasn't, at the time that I did this research or started this research, wasn't a lot of knowledge about, you know, how do these workers understand AI, and also like how they, would they perceive its benefits and implications for, you know, real-world use. And so I really became interested in addressing these questions as well. And then from this work, you know, we found that, one, they had very low knowledge about AI, and then also that they had lots of misconceptions about how AI works. And, you know, we found this troubling just because, you know, in the case that AI produces an incorrect prediction, we don't want them to, you know, go along with these. We want them to, you know, have the authority to actually basically kind of rebut against, you know, what AI is saying. And so that's how I also got into AI explainability, because we figured, if we can make AI explainable, you know, to community healthcare workers and also just like other users like them who have low levels of knowledge about AI, then we can, you know, make AI more useful and feasible in these environments that they're working in. So, yeah.
That's very interesting, because I never really thought about the development of AI turning into the world of haves and have nots. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine just seeing doctors and healthcare workers in rural India really shined a light on that. Can you explain a little bit more about how we're going to build a more equitable AI landscape?
Yeah. So I think that's, you know, definitely multiple parts to this. A lot of work recently has come out showing that, you know, the grunt work or the data work of AI is really being done primarily by, you know, low paid workers that are based in the global south or just, you know, in developing regions, let's say. And so people don't really realize that, you know, to have AI systems, you need a lot of data. But first, this data has to be collected, then processed, and which means like labeling, cleaning it. But again, like a lot of this work is being done by people who are not one, who are being like unfairly compensated, you know, for this work and also being like subjected just to, you know, very monotonous, you know, as days of just like sitting at a computer labeling data. And so, again, these people don't have like a lot of knowledge or like strong technical knowledge about AI. And so their perspectives are not really included in the actual development. And from my knowledge, from what I understand, like a lot of AI development is really focused more so in the West. And so by the West, I mean like United States and Europe, et cetera. There's also a lot of development being done in China as well. But again, you know, the perspective of, you know, people that live in the majority of the world is being left out. And so we've seen already that, you know, AI systems have been biased against like underrepresented minorities, you know, within Western contexts like the United States. But also there are wider implications for its use just based on, you know, on these present day challenges.
So you incorporated ethnography as you went out into rural India. What were some of the things you found? Were healthcare workers incorporating AI into diagnostics? Mm-hmm. What were some of the things, and how is that going to be something that we'll see around the world? Will it really enhance medical care, for example, and make healthcare workers more effective because they can reach more people?
Yeah, definitely. And so my work really focused more so on prototyping. And so we weren't working with real world AI systems yet. But, you know, in India, there are actual systems that have been deployed and been rolled out, especially when it came to helping, you know, counteract the effects of COVID. And so for my work, first we examined pneumonia diagnosis. And then my most recent work, we actually traveled to India, focused on jaundice diagnosis. And so, again, these were both prototypes. And so really found out that while the community healthcare workers didn't have a lot of knowledge about AI, they're very enthusiastic about using it. And even though we mentioned to them that our work was just in like very early stages, they wanted to actually have these applications and even mentioned that, you know, they wish they could have like AI for use in, for COVID, for example. And so other things as well is that they understood that even though like AI is kind of being seen as something that can do their work for them, they mentioned that, you know, they still want to be and they actually have to be involved because one, their patients, you know, may not necessarily accept AI, even though it may seem like a flashy or like a very cool thing. And especially when it comes to very sensitive conversations, you know, India is a very patriarchal society. And so it's hard for women to have, you know, discreet conversations about breastfeeding or just like family planning and like birth control. And so community healthcare workers are usually women. And so they have these conversations, you know, with women in their communities about this. And you know, these women don't want to have such conversations with the AI chatbot. They want to talk to an ASHA, that's what they call community healthcare workers in India, about these specific, these very sensitive conversations. And so, you know, there's still overall like a very human aspect, you know, needed within AI. And these community healthcare workers realize it. And so I think that was just one of the most like surprising things. And also, I would say like very endearing things I've seen within my work in India.
I'm curious how you ended up choosing India to focus your work and what your experiences were like working in that country.
Yeah. Let's see. So my advisors, I was kind of tri-advising my PhD, but the people I primarily worked with, they both went to the University of Washington, UW, for their PhDs, and they were in one of the premier labs for information and communication technologies for development, also called ICTD. And so this work really just focuses on, you know, improving the information and communication technologies for use in the developing world. And so for their work, that you know, they had been in India, all over like different countries in Africa, doing very similar things. They weren't really working. One of my advisors did like some AI projects as well. And so I think that interest just really came naturally. One, because they have the connections and experience, and then also just because it was just easy to kind of integrate myself, you know, within that work and also kind of carve out my own path. And also one of my advisors is Indian himself, and so really helped because I don't speak Hindi. So he's super helpful. And also one of my lab mates is Indian, and he's very helpful in like just the planning and the implementation part of my research project. And so interacting with the community healthcare workers, you know, interviewing them about their experiences, even though I was in charge of the design. And overall, like the experience, you know, was very, you know, different from anywhere I've been. I actually do see a lot of parallels between like India and Nigeria. You know, like when I landed in Delhi. And so I was like, it smelled like very similar. I think it's just like a smell of air pollution. But yeah, it was very interesting. I was in like super rural India. And so, but I think one thing that surprised me was that there was a lot or very strong like internet or like a phone connection. Cause like I was in upstate New York, and like sometimes the internet connection or like my connection to my cellular provider was like, could be very bad. So it was like so interesting seeing that, you know, that, that difference. But and also like my advisors did like prepare me or like try to brace me in advance, because they mentioned that you'd probably be like the first Black person like, you know, these people ever see. And so for me, it was kind of like a little bit of like celebrity-ish, like people were taking photos with me and like, you know, stares and all that stuff. But I became comfortable with it. And also my lab mate was very helpful in kind of like shielding people who were trying to like take pictures with me when we visited like it wasn't a mosque, but it was just like a temple. Yeah. So I had a good experience overall. Got to visit a couple cities within the country. And overall, I definitely would love to come back.
Now, you're also researching AI in Africa and the impact of generative AI in Africa. First off, remind us of what generative AI is. And then how is it being accepted and used within Africa?
So generative AI has really, you know, come into like the public purview over the past year, especially with the advent of tools like ChatGPT. So essentially, you know, it's the use of, you know, large models that have been trained on different kinds of data, whether it be like image, you know, text, videos, you know, and the goal is to produce, you know, novel content. And so we're most really familiar with ChatGPT, which is a text model. And also there are other models like from OpenAI, like DALL-E, which, you know, are text to image models. And so this work is like really preliminary. I just got it accepted as a poster at a conference. And so looking forward to building on the work. But basically, I've seen a lot of it being used to help produce like news articles, especially when it comes to things like elections. There also have been some cases that I'm investigating about the use of AI to produce like, there was a case, a presidential candidate in Nigeria. There was allegedly a faked call that was, you know, created, that was trained on his voice and a voice of like a religious figure in Nigeria. And so I'm still investigating that. But there's also been cases of AI being used to generate like marketing images as well. And so I'm really interested in the misinformation aspect of that, just because there are lots of implications for using, you know, these kinds of images in media. So. Yeah.
You mentioned Nigeria a lot, so I want to take a step back because I read that your parents are immigrants from Nigeria, correct?
Yes, that's
How
correct.
Has that shaped your perspective in everything that you've done?
Yeah, definitely. I would say it's definitely had a very big impact on me. Just, you know, wanting to, you know, acknowledge my heritage, you know, being in America, I think you kind of get swept up in the culture here because it dominates like here and also just like around the world in general. But I think honestly, like being at Pomona was the first time I was surrounded by, you know, other Nigerians, especially like those that were born in the country. My best friend, you know, at Pomona, you know, was Nigerian born, and also just like students from other African countries. I was also very involved in the Pan-African Student Association as a co-president during my senior year. And also just like throughout my time at Pomona. And so just wanting to have that connection to the African continent, you know, was really important to me. And overall, I would say like my interest in healthcare also kind of grew out of that, just because growing up, yeah, I would always hear my parents talking about, you know, how family members were suffering back home. And a lot of the suffering like came, you know, due to the healthcare system and just like, you know, being unable to get, you know, adequate healthcare. And so I think that also kind of drove my interest in healthcare, along with my parents also wanting me to be a medical doctor. But, you know, now I'm a doctor of computer science. So, I hope that,
A different kind of doctor helping doctors.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you see AI transforming medicine?
Definitely in a lot of different ways, both, you know, within rural contexts like India, which I focus on, and also in more developed context. So in rural healthcare, I would say, especially there's also like rural context within the United States and other, you know, quote unquote developed countries. I mean, so I think it really serves, could serve as a conduit in just improving general access. And so telemedicine really arose through, you know, throughout the pandemic. And I kind of see like AI, you know, supplementing existing telemedicine, you know, services by, you know, allowing people to get like diagnostics done, you know, through meeting with their healthcare provider, and also just like AI being used, let's say just to help in healthcare allocation or just like, you know, directing people to relevant healthcare services. In the real world, or the developing world, quote unquote, I see AI being used to supplement like community healthcare workers and also just, you know, people having access to diagnostic devices, you know, on their mobile devices or like AI powered diagnostics on their mobile devices, just really to help them, you know, be able to not really self-diagnose, but, you know, be able to take an image, you know, get a diagnosis from that app and then also being able to connect to a doctor or a medical professional and just helping them kind of like reduce their time, the time needed to take off of work, you know, travel far away to like a better hospital, et cetera. And so there's many opportunities there.
I remember 2015, 2016, back when you were studying AI as a computer science major, just AI was not there yet. And it was kind of discussed as, in terms of my perspective, something that wasn't necessarily going to overtake society for a number of years. All of a sudden, there's been exponential gains in AI capabilities. Mm-hmm. Has that surprised you as to how fast it's grown, or have you always anticipated this?
Yeah, so I can't really say I anticipated it, but it doesn't really surprise me. I think just technology in general has seen this development, you know, over the decades. I'm only a couple decades old, but I'm just like understanding how it's grown, especially when it comes to like microchips or and GPUs and also just like computers in general, you know, just having access to lots of different functions just from one, you know, smartphone. I mean, I think that's just really impressive within itself. But AI overall, I think one thing that's really surprised me is how like knowledgeable or just like informed the public has become of its presence. And so I think ChatGPT is definitely probably like the tool that probably has like the most responsibility to play in terms of, you know, that public awareness of AI. And so I think it'll just be interesting to see how it continues to evolve over the next couple years and decades.
So you're also working in helping to formulate AI governance. Tell us about your new job.
Yes. So I recently started as a fellow at the Brookings Institution. So the Brookings Institution really focuses on just public policy in general. Within Brookings, I'm situated within the Center for Technology Innovation. And so we basically cover all aspects of technology, but a strong focus is on AI. And so later on in my PhD, I got really interested in questions about you know, AI governance, especially how it pertains to emerging markets, like in India or just like Africa in general. And I wanted to really, my research showed me a lot of connections. And I also started some work with the African Union in terms of helping to develop a continental strategy for AI. And so I figured that you know, post-PhD, it would be really interesting to figure out how I can center my career on some of these questions and also, you know, address some of the questions domestically within the U.S. In terms of, you know, how can we help, I would say, address some of the concerns about AI, especially when it comes to more so like legislative efforts in governing and regulating, you know, these tools.
What do you see as some of the ethical issues that need to be addressed?
Oh, yeah. There's so many. Within healthcare, we've seen a lot of use cases in terms of biased healthcare algorithms that are, you know, let's see, are likely to like recommend Black patients for lower levels of care, you know, versus, you know, patients of other races. Within the United States, the TSA has also been like very active in adopting these facial recognition technologies, you know, but again, work from Joy Bulamwini, a researcher I mentioned earlier, and also like Timnit Gebru have really shown that these technologies are biased against, more likely to be biased against women, and then, you know, they perform worse on women of darker skin tones. And so I just, on my way, like coming to Pomona, I saw that, you know, TSA is using facial recognition in the checkpoints. I use a service called Clear. They're only scanning my eyes. But I mean, it's, you know, there's also, you know, concerns with that as well. And so I think there has to be, you know, more public conversation about these technologies. And then also just like in education. We've seen that ChatGPT has become very popular for students to help supplement their writing, and also just like concerns about people being falsely accused of using these technologies. And so I think there needs to be more public conversation and you know, just like general participation in helping to understand how we can advance these conversations.
How do you work to lessen the biases in these AI technologies as they emerge and become part of our daily lives?
I guess in terms of bias, like, honestly, there will always be some kind of bias. I think there's just better ways in terms to alleviate how, like, these AI tools are actually being deployed, especially when it comes to things like I mentioned, like, you know, TSA and other use cases as well. And I'm, you know, data is also a very big part of this. I think there has to be like more meaningful participation from people that have different kinds of expertise, like, you know, computer scientists, you know, or engineers are not, or software engineers are not, you know, the only ones that have the expertise needed to contribute to like data collection or just like AI development in general. There needs to be, you know, people with legal backgrounds, you know, from psychology, anthropology, sociology, et cetera. And so I think these voices are really needed in the development of AI.
What worries you about AI?
Honestly, not many things. I think the biggest thing for me is that it'll serve the interests of large corporations and not really serve the needs of people who are marginalized. I think my main concern is AI actually exacerbating existing disparities, especially when it comes to things like policing, healthcare, education, economic opportunity. And so I think it's really important that, you know, again, people from marginalized backgrounds be included in conversations in terms of like how AI is developed and governed as well.
I guess on the flip side of that, what most excites you about AI?
Yeah, so many different things. I would say some fields that really intrigue me, especially pertain to like interpretable ML. And so I mentioned like earlier, like my research really focuses on AI explainability, but interpretability is really focused on just like making sure that the models themselves are understandable and just, I'd say, I guess, interpretable, you know, to humans alike. And so I think it could actually solve some of the issues that we see with explainability, because honestly, like, explainability can be kind of seen as like a band-aid solution for the lack of interpretability or the black box that we're seeing with these kind of models. And then other fields like TinyML really focus on expanding like computing access of machine learning models to smaller devices like smartphones or smartwatches. And I think this really would be helpful, especially when it comes to healthcare and improving, you know, like how we can run advanced machine learning models on device so people can have, you know, better access to healthcare.
So your watch telling you that your heart is acting up? Is that what you're talking about?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. But also just like, you know, for community healthcare workers, you know, the cloud, you know, is there. But, you know, some places that don't have like good connectivity to data, you know, you can't really rely on a cloud. And so if you can run these machine learning models on your device, and it can save you a lot of time and also provide you, you know, with more accurate results as well.
So what contribution do you want to make in the near future and longer term? What do you envision your future in this field to be?
Yeah, so many different things. But I would say just like, you know, one, opening up the conversation on AI governance to, you know, regions that have been underrepresented, especially within the African context. I've been fortunate to be able to work with the African Union. But honestly, the conversations that we've seen around, you know, AI regulation have really been focused on the United States, other places like Canada, the EU has definitely been a leader. But, you know, there are these countries, you know, that, you know, have economies that will make impactful contributions, you know, to the world. And so also they should be included in these conversations.
How impactful can these technologies be on developing countries?
Yeah. So, again, so many different ways, but I think one in terms of helping to kind of advance traditional industries, you know, like manufacturing, agriculture, especially agriculture, just because a lot of African countries or countries within the global south rely, you know, on, you know, this domain. And so there's lots of needs, you know, to help predict, you know, what crops will do best in a certain season, or for example, to, you know, quickly identify diseases that are affecting crops, just to ensure that, you know, they don't, I would say, kill like an entire yield. And so I think that's really important for AI. AI could like be really important in agriculture.
And I know it's this whole conversation has kind of had this overarching theme, but why is it important that your research focus on the global south to you personally?
Yeah, so again, just having that personal connection, you know, to Nigeria, and also just like seeing a, you know, very similar challenges throughout other countries within Africa, and also other regions like India, you know, and in Latin America. And so, and not to say like, you know, no one is really addressing these concerns, because there are thousands of researchers and like initiatives that are focused on AI in the global south. But, you know, I happen to come from, you know, privileged background in terms of like my educational being, you know, educated at Cornell and Pomona, has provided me like, you know, with a platform to kind of address or like highlight these issues, you know, more prominently. And so also now being at Brookings as well. And so I think it's, I really want to get these conversations started and hopefully, you know, ensure that other people that, you know, actually have these real life experiences of growing up in the global south and, you know, developing countries can meaningfully contribute and, you know, advance AI development.
Is the field of computer science becoming more diverse? And how will that help the field to represent more people?
Yeah, so I haven't looked at the stats recently, but I believe so. Just understanding, like, you know, engineering departments at U.S. universities, you know, are becoming more gender balanced. And when it comes to underrepresented minorities, the degrees are increasing. And so I would say yes to a certain extent. I think for me, when it comes to the actual like AI development or just computer science in general, that, you know, you can have more minorities or just like more people with marginalized backgrounds like in these fields. But, you know, if they aren't being like, if their voices aren't being elevated and, you know, they're not given the opportunity to like take leadership positions and actually like meaningfully contribute, you know, to like technical development, then, you know, there's not going to be any change. And so you have to be really intentional about how, you know, you include these people.
And I would imagine a lot of your job or when you're out there is educating people on what AI is. And I'm sure there's a lot of misinformation or fears about AI. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're experiencing a lot when you're talking with people?
Yeah, most definitely. And it's, I would say it's really sad to see like a lot of this misinformation or these just like very wild conspiracies are being spouted by people who are actually like very involved with technical development of these systems. And so, or like are the leaders or the have done foundational work in AI and machine learning. And so I think one misconception is that like AI can kind of take over the world. You know, it's going to cause like mass destruction or like lead to the, you know, World War III. But the thing is, like, as I mentioned previously, humans are still very involved in AI development, whether it starts from, you know, collecting data to training the models and actually choosing where to deploy them. And so humans are involved like in every stage of the AI lifecycle. And so it's really important to understand that like humans have control over AI. Like AI will never, you know, like take control on its own.
How do we keep from having blind spots in AI because we don't have enough data for them to learn?
Right.
To avoid things like not having enough different types of people, nationalities, mm-hmm. and diversity represented?
Yeah. So again, as I've mentioned, that it's really important that to include people, you know, from those backgrounds. And, you know, it may not necessarily like seem feasible to do so. But again, like large companies like Google and Microsoft, you know, have resources. And unfortunately, you know, they have expanded their footprints, you know, into underrepresented regions, you know, throughout the world. So like Microsoft and Google both have like research labs within India. They also have research labs within South Africa, Kenya, Nigeria, and Ghana as well. And so there's been lots of efforts from their end. But I also want to definitely recognize the efforts of like a local grassroots effort initiatives. There have been a lot within the African continent, especially like deep learning in Daba, Ghana NLP, and Masakane. And they've been really focused on, you know, like training African researchers, one, you know, to like collect their own data and also like be intentional in how they train AI systems that cater to like local languages. And so they've actually done a lot of work in, you know, filling this gap, you know, from systems like, you know, from systems from companies like Microsoft and Google. So
when you think about your future in AI, do you anticipate it being more about public policy or boots on the ground grassroots movement?
Yeah, I would say definitely a mix of that. For right now, really focused just on public policy, just because there's just so many conversations happening right now. And, you know, we've seen an urgent need to regulate how AI is being developed, deployed, and just used in daily life. And so I think right now it seems like a good point for me to focus my career on that. But I'm really interested in the future and just like, you know, founding my own thing, especially when it comes to like doing more so like grassroots AI initiatives. I'm definitely interested in being based somewhere on the African continent, still trying to figure out where. Nigeria is, you know, an obvious choice, but I really like, you know, places like South Africa. And I had the chance to visit Rwanda earlier this year with the African Union and had a really great time there. And they also have like a thriving tech scene. And so, yeah, I just definitely want to contribute any way I can.
Chinasa, it's very comforting me personally that with somebody with your kind of information is not pessimistic about the future of AI. I want to thank you for sitting down and hanging out with us at SageCast.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's been great.
Thank you for the invite. I appreciate it.
Wow, AI is a topic we'll no doubt be discussing and trying to wrap our heads around for years to come. It certainly fits our theme of tackling the difficult.
Thanks for being with us for this episode of SageCast, and thanks to our audio engineer, Eric Tyron, and KSBC for hosting our conversations. Until next time.